This was 1954, and here were some of its voices.
Well, what are you telling communists for? You ain't got nothing over there. You better come home, Jim.
The first shot whizzed by me, and I immediately followed my knowledge of war and hit the deck, as we say.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness.
I've always liked bird dogs better than kennel-fed dogs myself.
The same ADA left-wing clique who captured the Democratic Party at its national convention in Chicago.
America has already made its decision on those demagogues who rely on defamation.
The people of Georgia will not stand for non-segregated schools.
The white child has something to offer the colored child, as well as the colored child has something to offer the white child.
I had the luck to be called upon to give the roar.
Cry and cry. That was all we could do.
There will be no war.
...1954, the first year of the past 25 during which the cannon of major warfare were silenced. Peace in Korea, and in Indochina, an uneasy armistice which some considered a defeat. But a year when fears of another immediate global conflict temporarily were eased. The Paris treaties, and greater cohesion and strength for the forces of the free world, and growing conciliation in the voice of the Kremlin. At home, a turn of the political tide in off-year elections. To these and 100 other dramas, CBS correspondents throughout the world had a front-row seat. And on tape, they recorded 1954's voices, sounds, and events for lasting record. During the next full hour, we'll review the year 1954 through the voices of those great and small who helped write its story. This was 1954. The war in Korea had faded into bickering peace. There was wrangling over the prisoner exchange and indignation at a handful of Americans who chose to remain behind the bamboo curtain. The father of one of those turncoat prisoners made a heartbroken plea.
Jim, hello. This is your father talking to you. I've been waiting for 3 years to come home see you. What's the matter? What are you telling communists for? You ain't got nothing over there. You better come on this beautiful land you bought and stay forever.
But those Americans remained, and the peace was signed, but only to free the communist strength for attacks in another quarter. For 7 years, the grim war in Indochina had bled France white. Now the Reds assaulted in strength, and Vietnam's mountains and rice paddies erupted in flame. An unpronounceable dot on the world's huge map was encircled in red. But despite the encircled garrison's heroic stand and the bravery of American pilots who flew through a hurricane of bullets to deliver the supplies, Dien Bien Phu was conquered. Now the big question, should American forces enter the struggle and help save strategic Vietnam for the West? As usual, opinion was varied.
Send the H-bomb over to Russia and knock out Moscow. Keep us out of war regardless of anything.
Send the American soldiers there. It is important to the whole world to save that end of the world.
I think we should send American soldiers there to prevent it from falling into communist hands.
I'd sure send American soldiers there to save the country.
I certainly wouldn't let it fall into their hands.
Well, I lost two brothers in the last war, so I'm kind of against sending our boys to a foreign country unless they start attacking us. Well, then that's something different.
The White House decision soon was made. No troops or ships to Indochina. Instead, SEATO, a defense pact with our Pacific allies to prevent communism's further spread in that quarter of the world. In the words of State Secretary Dulles,
this common defense may involve serious commitments by us all. Furthermore, vital interests can no longer be protected merely by local defense. The key to successful defense and the key to deterring attack is association with others for mutual defense. And that is what the United States seeks in Southeast Asia.
At Geneva, an armistice, and Vietnam was divided into half, the Communist North and the Anti-Communist South. Meantime, in the far Pacific, our scientists continued work on the hydrogen bomb.
15 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
There comes the sound wave.
Atomic Commissioner Strauss immediately took to the microphone to ease fears of this awesome force.
One important result of these hydrogen bomb developments has been the great enhancement of our military capability to the point where we should soon be more free to increase our emphasis on the peaceful use of atomic power at home and abroad.
Dig, die, or get out. That was the warning from Civil Defense Chief Val Peterson. And Spokane became the first major American city to test total evacuation from the business district.
The air raid siren atop one of the larger buildings in the downtown area wailed its warning. In the background can be heard the anti-aircraft and machine gun firing as the gunners warm up with blank rounds from the tops of buildings. The siren brought immediate results as the people flooded out into the rain from buildings and made their way calmly to the loading points where buses would ordinarily be waiting to transport them out of the city. Inasmuch as the alert just affected the downtown area, the people went only as far as the loading perimeter where they remained until the bombers flew over, dropped their imaginary bomb, and the all-clear sounded. During the interim period, we asked for the thoughts of several bystanders as to the importance and seriousness of the walkout.
I think it's a wonderful thing.
People in the country naturally know that sometime we're liable to get some of this stuff, and it's a good idea to practice and know where you're going.
I think it's a bunk. It gets you anyhow.
Why, I think it's a grand thing.
At 10 o'clock, right on schedule, the B-36 bomber flew directly over the center of the city and dropped several hundred leaflets in the shape of bombs that fell over the major part of the city. On those leaflets were the words, "This could have been an H-bomb." At 5 minutes past 10, the very welcome all clear sounded. As to the conclusions reached by the civil defense personnel,
it could now be adjudged possible for any city comparable in size to Spokane to successfully evacuate the downtown area.
The awful realization of what atoms for war could mean to your city and mine gave added urgency to President Eisenhower's world proposal of atoms for peace.
The governments principally involved, to the extent permitted by elementary prudence, to begin now and continue to make joint contributions from their stockpiles of normal uranium and fissionable materials to an international atomic energy agency. Thus, the contributing powers would be dedicating some of their strength to serve the needs rather than the fears of mankind.
But while the diplomats were pondering atomic power and Cold War strategy, our Congress was settling domestic issues. And in the House of Representatives one early spring day, the drone of debate was shattered by gunfire from the gallery, and one lawmaker fell wounded. Congressman Van Zandt told about it.
The first shot whizzed by me, and I immediately followed my knowledge of war and hit the deck, as we say, and then got to my feet again and ran to the gallery. The doors flew open, and out come a Puerto Rican girl. And following her were the three Puerto Rican men who were waving their pistols in the air. And along with some other spectators and I think another member of Congress, we finally got them to the floor and took their pistols from them.
The assassination-minded advocates of Puerto Rican independence, four men and a woman, were jailed. But soon another type of shooting broke out, the verbal type. Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin was infuriated to learn that Army dentist Paris had been promoted to major despite his refusal to answer questions about communist affiliations. McCarthy scheduled Paris's commanding general to appear before his committee.
If a stupid, arrogant, or witless man in a position of power appears before our committee and is found aiding the Communist Party, he will be exposed. The fact that he might be a general places him in no special class as far as I am concerned.
McCarthy's own party split down the middle over his so-called methods, And the Democrats' titular leader, Adlai Stevenson, said this.
A political party divided against itself, half McCarthy and half Eisenhower, cannot produce national unity, cannot govern with confidence and with purpose.
Among those who spoke out against McCarthy was commentator Edward R. Murrow. The senator and Mr. Murrow made the following exchange.
I have a little difficulty answering the specific attacks that he made because I never listened to the extreme left-wing, bleeding-heart elements of radio or television.
The senator may have me there. I may be a bleeding heart, being not quite sure of what it means. As for being extreme left-wing, that is political shorthand. But if the senator means that I am somewhat to the left of his position and of Louis XIV, he is correct.
Vice President Richard Nixon expressed the administration's view.
The president, this administration, the responsible leadership of the Republican Party, insist that whether in the executive branch of the government or in the legislative branch of the government, the procedures for dealing with the threat of communism in the United States must be fair and they must be proper. When you do it unfairly and with irresponsibility, all that you do is to give ammunition to those who oppose any action against the communists.
As for the American public, you were either for McCarthy or against him. Few, it seemed, were neutral.
Well, I think McCarthy is doing a wonderful job.
I don't know. I don't see anybody ever behave the way that fellow's behaving.
I don't, frankly, like his tactics.
I think if his investigation could be regulated, whereby a person is innocent until they're proven guilty, and that'd be so tough on him. I'd like it a whole lot better, but I think the idea is excellent, and we should do it.
I won't make any comments.
I think it's a little bit too one-sided.
I think he's a good man to have around the U.S.
He's good to have, but I don't care for the way he handles it.
And I don't think it's a good thing, and I think that's what made America great, was that people were able to express their opinions, think what they want, and that's the only way we got ahead. Otherwise, we're going to be just like Russia.
I wished he was president of the United States.
And while the United States discussed McCarthy, the British, too, were debating a political issue. Should the aging Sir Winston Churchill retire as Prime Minister?
Why should he retire? I mean, he's got the brains.
Well, he's done his job, and he's done a good job while he was at it. And now...
Well, he can still carry on. He's still got the brains.
Now he should take it easy and live on his laurels.
While he's got his facilities and while he's got the brains, why should he retire? He's one of the cleverest men we've ever had.
No, I don't think so.
Do you think?
I think he's too old now.
He's not too old.
He is.
He's got his facilities and he's not too old. Now, look, he's the only man that can stand up in any anywhere and make a speech right off, no hesitation. No hesitation at all. He can stand up
anywhere.
He's
not as quick now as he used to be. His flowery thoughts, his flowery movement. He's a great statesman, but he still hasn't got the brain power that he had 30 years ago.
Right.
I think he's too great a man now to be jibbed at in politics or anything like that. He's far too great a man for that. He's a figurehead today, and he shouldn't take part in politics.
Yes, he shouldn't.
No.
Yes, he should. I think he should.
But British argument over Sir Winston momentarily was eclipsed by an electrifying athletic achievement. Roger Bannister became history's first man to crack the four-minute mile, and Australia's Landy soon followed suit. And a notable film achievement. The picture, From Here to Eternity, won more Oscars than any production since Gone with the Wind. It was a great comeback for one award winner, singer Frank Sinatra, in the role of Maggio.
Let's get out of here before we get in trouble, okay?
What's the matter with you? Can't a man get drunk? Can't a man do nothing? Can't a man put his lousy hands in his lousy pockets on a lousy street? Man gotta be hounded all his life? Well, I'm tired. I ain't no criminal. I ain't no coward.
Hey, MPs! Come and get me, you guys! Here I am!
And an even greater comeback. Singer Judy Garland, as she was showered with plaudits at the premiere of A Star Is Born.
I don't know what to say except that I am overwhelmed, and I think it's a thrilling night, and I hope our work has lived up to the compliments people are giving us tonight. It's too thrilling to talk about. I'd rather talk after the picture. Maybe they won't like it at all.
But as the glamour center of youthful ambitions, Hollywood during 1954 took a back seat to the wild, rugged plateau country of Utah and Colorado. There, new uranium millionaires were being created almost overnight. Symbolic was Vernon Pick of Grand Junction, Colorado.
It all came about when my electrical business burned down in Minneapolis. I hadn't enough insurance to continue on in business, and so thinking it would be a long time before I had a chance to take a vacation, and my wife and I bought a house trailer and started on our long vacation trip to Mexico. We never got there. We got as far as Grand Junction, Colorado, and the news that I heard of uranium finds attracted me so much that I decided I would take a flyer into uranium prospecting. I wandered over the desert country of southern Utah for 9 long months. I prospected in out-of-the-way places where the competition from other more experienced men wasn't so great. And it wasn't, though, until I walked up the muddy river into the San Rafael Swell in south-central Utah that I managed to make it pay off when I discovered and staked out Delta Mines.
Well, now, when you sold your 10 mining claims for $9 million, I imagine you got some interesting mail.
The number of requests for money were so great that I'm afraid even $9 million wouldn't supply them all.
But for those Americans who didn't have $9 million, the cost of living continued to be a problem. But economic matters were all but forgotten in the storm of argument over Senator McCarthy's handling of General Zwicker. As McCarthy described that hearing,
I said, then, General, you should be removed from any command. Any man who has been given the honor of being promoted to general and who says, I will protect another general who protects communists, is not fit to wear that uniform, General.
President Eisenhower immediately made comment on this case.
The Department of the Army made serious errors in handling the Perez case, and the Secretary of the Army so stated publicly almost a month ago. All of us know that our military services and their leaders have always been completely loyal and dedicated public servants, singularly free of suspicion of disloyalty. In this tribute to the services, I mean to include General Zwicker, who was decorated for gallantry in the field.
The Army charged McCarthy's aide, Roy Cohn, of using threats to gain favorable treatment for another McCarthy aide, Private David Shine. McCarthy retorted, blackmail. And this led to the Army-McCarthy hearings, during which this statement became almost a national byword.
Mr. Chairman.
Are you so content?
I am content, sir. Point of order, Mr. Chairman. Point of order. Mr. Chairman, I want to make the very strong point of order that this is the most improper exhibition I have ever seen. You have a lawyer here badgering this private, and I think it's indecent, and I think the chair should condemn it.
Then followed the heated argument over a doctored photo, and the fight whether McCarthy had violated the law by producing a letter purported to be from secret FBI files. Thereupon, McCarthy attacked that law.
I think the time has come, Mr. Chairman, when we should determine whether or not the Congress has the power to get the necessary information to guard the security of this nation. We can get, Mr. Chairman, we can get information about dishonesty, about corruption, about graft, but it seems we cannot get information about something a thousand times worse, namely treason.
But that law remains unchanged. Finally came what most Americans considered the most dramatic day of the hearings. It started with Army Counsel Welch's cross-examination of McCarthy aide Roy Cohn.
Well, I kind of think that it's really dramatic to see how these communist hunters will sit on this document when they could have brought it to the attention of Bob Stevens in 20 minutes, and they let month after month go by without going to the head and saying, sick 'em, Stevens.
Senator Mudd.
Now, Mr. Cohn, I am turning back to my other matter.
Senator Mudd, may I answer that last question?
I had only said you didn't say sick 'em, Stevens, and you didn't, did you?
Then Senator McCarthy dropped this bombshell into the hearing.
In view of Mr. Welch's request that the information be given once we know of anyone who might be performing any work for the Communist Party, I think we should tell him that he has in his law firm A young man named Fisher, whom he recommended, incidentally, to do the work in this committee, who has been for a number of years a member of an organization which was named, years and years ago, as the legal bulwark of the Communist Party, an organization which always springs to the defense of anyone who dares to expose communists.
Then the hearing's most dramatic moment, as, shaken by emotion, Army Counsel Welch arose to reply.
Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness. Fred Fisher is a young man who went to the Harvard Law School and came into my firm and is starting what looks to be a brilliant career with us. When I decided to work for this committee, I asked Jim St. Clair, who sits on my right, to be my first assistant. I said to Jim, pick somebody in the firm to work under you that you would like. He chose Fred Fisher. And Fred Fisher said, Mr. Welch, when I was in the law school, and for a period of months after, I belonged to the Lawyers Guild, as you have suggested, Senator. He went on to say, I am secretary of the Young Republicans League in Newton with the son of Massachusetts governor. And I have the respect and admiration of my community, and I'm sure I have the respect and admiration of the 25 lawyers or so in Hale and Dorr. And I said, Fred, I just don't think I'm going to ask you to work on the case. If I do, one of these days that will come out and go over national television, and it will just hurt like the dickens. And so, Senator, I asked him to go back to Boston. Little did I dream you could be so reckless and so cruel as to do an injury to that lad. If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I would do so. But your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me.
Mr. Chairman, I just give this man's record, and I want to say, Mr. Welch, that it has been labeled long before he became a member, as early as 1944.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belonged to the Lawyers Guild.
You brought him down, did you not, to act as your assistant?
You have seen fit to bring it out, and if there is a God in heaven, it will do neither you nor your cause any good. I will not discuss it further. I will not ask Mr. Cohn any more witnesses. You, Mr. Chairman, may, if you will, call the next witness.
Are there any questions to come from the members of the chair?
And that was the hearing's only demonstration by onlookers. After 36 days of hearings, the gist of the majority report, there were discrepancies in the testimony of both sides. At Republican Senator Flanders' insistence, the Watkins Committee was selected to decide whether Senator McCarthy should be censured. President Eisenhower ended a lot of guessing, actively entered the campaign, and called for election of a Republican Congress.
You know perfectly well that you just can't have one car with two drivers at the steering wheel and expect to end up any place but in the ditch, especially when the drivers are set on going in different directions.
But Democratic spokesman Adlai Stevenson had a different view of GOP control of Congress and the White House.
And it is reassuring to find that there is no truth in the common rumor back east that 20 months of Republican performances in Washington have put Hollywood out of business.
Utah and the nation were jolted just before the election when GOP Congressman Douglas Stringfellow confessed his stories of wartime heroism were a hoax.
I fell into a trap which in part had been laid by my own glib tongue. And I am in this studio tonight for one purpose only, and that is to give you the complete truth. Here are the facts. I was never an OSS agent. I never participated in any secret behind-the-lines mission for our government. I never captured Otto Hahn or any other German physicist. I come before this radio and television audience tonight a humble, contrite, and very repentant individual. I have made some grievous mistakes. My heart is filled with sorrow for any or all who might have been hurt by my misstatements. I wish before my Heavenly Father that I might undo this wrong. I ask your forgiveness, and I assure you I will spend my lifetime in trying to make amends and repenting.
Republican candidates were given a stronger shock when Defense Secretary Wilson told reporters this.
I've got a lot of sympathy for people where a sudden change catches them. But I've always liked bird dogs better than kennel-fed dogs myself. You know, one that'll get out and hunt for food rather than sit on his fanny and yell.
Wilson later apologized. Meanwhile, labor leaders like Dave Beck were calling for more federal pump priming.
The present administration, in no sense, is measuring up to the tremendous responsibility that confronts us if we are going to restore employment to its proper level and get out from under what I consider a very serious recession.
This was just one of the matters Congress looked into. Another was the scandal in the Federal Housing Administration. The Capehart Committee heard a definition of a builder's windfall profit.
The government guaranteed a mortgage for $1 million. He got $1 million in cash. The project cost him $900,000. He had $100,000 left over. He not only had $100,000 left over, but he still owns the project.
And the senator questions a builder about his profits.
You and Mr. Weingart and the others in the group make a profit on the deal of $1,298,836.
Yes, sir.
And the investment was $15,000.
That's correct.
A frustrated woman victim of a deal testified, too.
If you can get anything on them, why can't I sue them?
Well, you can sue the people that sold you this if you can find them.
I'll find them.
Well, more power to you.
While the senators pondered new legislation to curb such practices, the U.S. Supreme Court stirred new controversy by ruling public school segregation unconstitutional. Georgia's Governor Talmadge said this.
The people of Georgia will not stand for non-segregated schools.
The precise percentage of public opinion backing Governor Talmadge's views is open to question. Negro leaders challenge it, but on the white side, it's the easiest reaction to come by. The taxi driver says so, and the mother of children in a white school says so, too.
I don't think I could ever get accustomed to it myself.
But a Negro mother was by no means so sure.
I think it would be pretty nice for them, you know, if they would get together, but I doubt it.
Some unofficial opinion of white teenagers.
I just don't see it as fit for colored people to go to schools with white people, because I think it'd be a lot of fighting there.
There were younger Negroes, high school students, who were more hopeful on integrating the races in school.
If the politician will give the bill a break, I think it will work out fine, because the younger people nowadays are accepting each other. I mean, each person as a person.
The armed forces of the United States had decreed an end to segregation long before the court's decision on schools. The young white veteran said,
well, I was in the service about 4.5 years with them, and I served with them, and I found out it worked pretty good.
As a Negro scholar, President Benjamin E. Mays of Morehouse College points out,
less than 100 years ago, it was exceedingly dangerous to talk about woman suffrage or to advocate the theory that women should be educated on a basis of equality with men. My guess is that in a very few years, we will wonder why we were so excited over this thing.
Perhaps the best advice to both sides is summed up in these few words of a Negro mother.
A white child has something to offer the colored child, as well as the colored child has something to offer the white child. If we in our homes would teach our children to practice love and how to treat people, we won't have anything to fear.
Although 1954 ended rather quietly on the international scene, there were those who considered this the lull before the storm. In fact, South Korean President Syngman Rhee urged the West to attack Red China.
If we are to save democracy and the freedom of mankind, we must employ every necessary means, including war. Slavery of mind, body, and soul is a fate far worse than death.
But British Labour Party leader Clement Attlee, who made a tour of Red China, advocated peaceful coexistence during a news conference in San Francisco.
But if you try to put a kind of ring around China to keep her out from the west of the world, you will inevitably drive her more and more into the hands of Russia, and you will inevitably intensify the communist regime.
I would like to ask you a question.
Oh, no, I finished thinking.
Oh, I see. Just another change.
No, all finished. No questions.
What we wanted to ask was how would we go about having a peaceful coexistence with the communist world?
Yes, no questions.
Well, no questions on
that. No, I've made the statement. Finish.
No more questions, Mr. Finish.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
No thanks at all. No questions.
What did the average American think of attacking Red China? Here are some answers.
I don't let a sleeping dog lie.
I don't think the time is ripe. I believe the others are. The China is in a better position than we are.
Our leaders in this country are best qualified to feel when, if that should be taken, should take place.
I really don't think that we should go in.
I think it's okay.
I've always found when you go out and look for a fight, you usually get what you're looking for. You don't always win.
I believe that this country has put their nose in too many things and then got the worst end of it.
The situation remained tense in the Far East, but in Europe, the Western Alliance made progress, as reported by Secretary of State Dulles at the conference in London.
This final act of the London conference, just signed at Lancaster House by the representatives of 9 participating governments, created a moment of deep emotion. There was a general feeling that Western defense had been set upon a secure and constructive path that would contribute to world peace.
And Pierre Mendès-France, Premier of France, proved a good prophet when he made this pledge of ratification of the agreements.
The Paris agreements, which are essential to the strength of the free world, have been concluded. Ratification should be accomplished quickly. And so far as France is concerned, I think I can assure you that it will be.
The attention of millions was turned momentarily by the critical illness of Pope Pius XII, who earlier had officiated at sainthood ceremonies for Pius X.
Ad honorem et sanctet individue trinitatis, ad exaltationem et fide catholici et christiani religionis documentum, Autoritate Domini nostri Gesù Christi, Beatorum Apostolorum Petri et Pauli.
The life of Egyptian Premier Nasser was threatened, too, by assassins, as we hear in this on-the-scene account, narrated by Alan Jackson. Listen, if you will, to Egyptian Premier Nasser as he addressed 100,000 people at a rally in Alexandria. His speech is broken, first with brief applause and then with the 8 pistol shots. And then Nasser continues on the microphone, shouting directions to the police and to the crowd. Those final words of the premier in Egyptian were directed to the crowd and said, "If this is an attempt on my life, remember that each of you is Nasser too, and the revolution must go on." Tragedy struck in the form of a flood at Dhaka, East Pakistan, but the U.S. Army and Air Force rushed in men and medicine to help.
Many of the people, you must remember, have never been inoculated before and have to be convinced that there's nothing wrong or they won't be hurt by the needles. There's a huge crowd around us once again. You probably heard that, and I understand. They were pointing to their children and showing me the lack of clothing, and that they're pointing to their children's mouths and explaining that their children were hungry and haven't eaten. They have no clothes to wear. Pleading in their eyes needs no interpretation.
At home, the U.S. government was host to such distinguished visitors as the Queen Mother of England and the famous British General Montgomery, who kept a Los Angeles audience laughing with reference to a once unfunny subject, the War of 1812.
Later on, we moved, there was a great battle outside Washington. And I forget to say that Washington caught fire. And the White House got burned down. Now, when I was in Washington in 1946, after the war, I went to see President Truman. And I said, I'm sorry, sir, if my regiment burned down this place. Perhaps you would like to adjust that in the Marshall Aid Program. Well, the White House in those days wasn't in very good order, I believe is all right now. And President Truman said, well, as far as I'm concerned, you can come and burn the damn place down again.
Other famous men were celebrating birthdays. British Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill marked his 80th birthday with a speech. This man the world remembers for his statement in May of 1940, when World War II had begun.
I have never promised anything about blood, tears, toil, and sweat.
Then in June 1940, when things were black, Churchill said this.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
In September 1940, Churchill gave this tribute to the men who fought the Battle of Britain.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
The master of the English language put a new expression into use when he said at Fulton, Missouri in March 1946,
from Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
This year, Sir Winston Churchill told the House of Commons on his 80th birthday,
it was the nation and the race dwelling all round the globe that had the lion heart. I had the luck to be called upon to give the roar.
Another famous voice was stilled by death, the voice of actor Lionel Barrymore, who just hours before he died quoted some favorite lines of his from Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more.
A player who was on the stage this year was baseball hero Marv Grissom, who pitched a winner for the Giants in the first game of the World Series. At his hometown of Red Bluff, California, Grissom received the key to the city.
It says, presented to Marvin Grissom, October the 13th, 1954, by the people of Red Bluff, our own national New York Giant World's Champion pitcher.
The World Series, the All-Star Game, even beating Brooklyn didn't make me feel this way. I think I better have relief. Thank you very much.
As the Giants' World Series victory moved out of the nation's spotlight, the political campaigners moved in.
Confusion can be avoided and steady progress assured only by electing a Republican majority to the Congress.
were it not for the fact that the Democrats in Congress have taken a constructive, cooperative, and protective course, the White House would have been even more seriously handicapped than it has been.
You see that those who are asking for the election of an anti-Eisenhower Congress are not the moderates, but the same ADA left-wing clique who captured the Democratic Party at its national convention in Chicago.
America has already made its decision on those demagogues who rely on defamation, on deceit and double talk.
Finally, November 2nd, election night. With control of Congress at stake, early predictions were a Democratic landslide. And this seemed borne out as the first top race was settled. Democrat Averell Harriman was elected governor of New York.
We will restore government with a heart in New York.
And those forecasts of a Democratic landslide grew as, in critical New Jersey, Senate candidate Charles Howell piled up such an impressive early lead over his Republican opponent Clifford Case that he made this victory statement.
The Democratic victory in New Jersey demonstrated, in my opinion, voters' dissatisfaction with the performance of the Republican-controlled 83rd Congress.
And in Los Angeles, congressional candidate James Roosevelt, who won, made this statement.
Actually, I was very happy about the results in New York, and I know that my mother has been very happy about them, too. I talked to her a few minutes ago, and she was very pleased with the election of Mr. Harriman as governor, and naturally as with my brother winning for attorney general. She's sort of hoping for the best. I hope to be able to call her up a little while later.
But both were wrong. In New Jersey, Democrat Howell lost that lead, and in New York, FDR Jr. went down to defeat. Because it became clear that this was a crazy, mixed-up election with little going according to form and some races fantastically close. In the early morning hours, Republican National Chairman Leonard Hall confessed,
"This election is so close that I just can't give any definite conclusions at this time."
But finally, it seemed that control of the House was settled. And the Democratic National Chairman, Stephen Mitchell, announced,
"It is clear that we shall organize the House of Representatives. The prospects are favorable that we will organize the Senate."
Morning came, and control of the Senate hung on the outcome of one senatorial race, that of Neuberger and Cordon in Oregon, because independent Senator Wayne Morse had announced he'd vote with the Democrats.
"I fought for years to try to liberalize the Republican Party. I woke up to the fact that it was hopeless."
The nation's eyes were on Oregon, and the race went down almost to the last precinct. But finally, the next afternoon, it seemed apparent that the Democrat, Richard Neuberger, had won by fewer than 2,000 votes. The Democrats would organize the Senate. And Neuberger, the man who made it possible, gave his belief on why he had become Oregon's first Democratic senator in 40 years.
"My opponent introduced a series of bills which, in the opinion of some people, endangered our national forests. Second, my opponent had led the fight against the Hill Oil for Education bill. That was the bill which would have used the offshore oil reserve revenues for the support of schools in all 48 states. And we pointed out that if the president was right when he referred to 20 years of Democratic rule in Washington, D.C., that then the things that he said had twice as much pertinence in Oregon after 40 years.
President Eisenhower commented on his future with a Democratic-controlled Congress.
"If they control the House, they certainly control the order in which bills can come up. It would seem to me to be the part of wisdom when you're dealing with humans to meet with them and see what you can get done. And just to butt your head up against a stone wall is no good. So I think there has to be conferring probably on every important measure. Are you ready to take this up? Will you take it up if I send it down?"
And the new Democratic National Chairman told of his party's attitude toward Ike.
"We do not hate Ike, but we do feel it is our function as the minority party in the administrative end of the government, but of course the majority party in the legislative end, to point out the deficiencies and the mistakes and the incapacities of this administration."
The Watkins Committee, reviewing censure charges against Senator McCarthy, refused to allow radio and television broadcast of the hearings. Senator McCarthy startled a lot of people by attacking President Eisenhower, alleging he was soft with communists.
"Unfortunately, the presidency is fit to congratulate those who hold up the exposure of communists in one breath and in the next breath urges patience, tolerance, and niceties to those who are torturing American uniformed men.
President Eisenhower, who never mentions McCarthy by name, made this comment.
I believe that the federal government has a continuous, definite obligation to study the needs of 163 million people. Now, that's the kind of a program that I stand for. And if there are enough people want to go along with it, then we have no fear. If people want to split off because of some other secondary or lesser consideration, that will have to be their business.
The president had many things on his mind because the Russians shot down another American Air Force plane and disclosed they were holding 11 American airmen in prison. But an American newsman, Dick Applegate, was finally released by the communists. He talked to his mother by phone from Hong Kong.
Dick, this is Mom. Dick.
Yes. Oh, hi.
This is Mom, my darling. How are you?
I'm fine, darling. How are you?
Oh, I'm so delighted.
Don't worry, honey. I'm all right.
You are?
All right.
Oh, fine.
Is everybody at home? Everybody well?
Well, Dick, we're not very well. We've been so worried about you.
One American airman died when the Russians shot his plane down near Japan. His mother in Los Angeles was grief-stricken.
When my husband came, I was going to tell him, but I said, no, it is better for him to have lunch, and then I will tell him. But after he finished his lunch, the telegram came saying that he was dead. Cry and cry, that was all we could do. We will try to work for the Lord and to save other precious lives. It has been always our work, but I think we will work with more love from now on in his memory.
As for those veterans of the Korean War still held by the Chinese Reds, here's what the man in the street thought we should do about it.
I think your action's the only way you're going to settle it.
I think the same.
To go after them, get them out, that's all. I think they should have left MacArthur up there to finish the job instead of bringing him home when they did. Speak softly, but carry a great big club and bat him down.
This was the subject of fiery debate at the United Nations, too, where the General Assembly voted to condemn the action after hearing from U.S. Delegate Lodge, British Delegate Nutting, and Malyuk of the Soviet Union.
The United Nations must show an equal interest in these men, who by their personal efforts sought to repel an aggression which the United Nations itself was opposing.
The United States delegate's appeal found vigorous support from the United Kingdom delegate, Mr. Anthony Nutting.
Do the Chinese authorities, does the Soviet delegate really believe that an American or a Britisher or any other serviceman of the United Nations command would elect to go spying in China in the uniform of his country? They went forth to uphold our cause. We must uphold theirs.
But Soviet Union delegate Malyuk again pressed his charge.
All the 13, having been put in the dock, confessed their participation in this whole criminal matter. All of them said that they fully realized that all these things were criminal acts.
The United Kingdom delegate, Mr. Nutting, returned to the General Assembly rostrum.
As Mr. Malyuk well knows, that is the remarkable and sinister feature of communist trials. The prisoner always confesses. The verdict is always guilty.
UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld is on a mission to Peiping to effect the release of the American airmen and other UN personnel. Would he succeed? Hammarskjöld's answer.
To succeed is to realize the possible. I think that's the proper reply in this case. Neither you nor I know what is possible.
The Senate Republican leader, William Noland of California, demanded that Red China be blockaded if necessary to get the men released.
I suggested a naval blockade because I think that that would make the matter so expensive to the Chinese communists that they would not only release our 13 uniformed personnel, but the 26 American civilians that we know are in communist prisons.
But Secretary of State Dulles explained the administration's position.
Our first duty is to exhaust peaceful means of sustaining our international rights and those of our citizens, rather than now resorting to war action such as a naval or air blockade of Red China.
But as the Western alliance appeared to grow stronger, there seemed to be more willingness to discuss arms reduction. In fact, a unanimous vote in the UN General Assembly called for disarmament talks by the United States, Russia, Canada, France, and Britain. Even Soviet delegate Andrei Vyshinsky, who died a few days after the decision, seemed more amicable.
The ground has been cleared for the further solution of difficult problems, for the overcoming of these problems. And we are confident that our partners will act in a like spirit in helping us compose these differences, overcome these difficulties. This is our sincere and ardent desire.
The Eisenhower administration felt the chances for peace were better than ever, and in good faith announced a cutback in the armed forces. President Eisenhower looked ahead in these words.
The free world has a better chance than before to build up a structure that will really be impervious to the communist assault, whether that assault takes its usual form of subversion and bribery and infiltration, or whether in the long run it might include force. I believe if we do this intelligently, work effectively toward the end, there will be no war.
With American soldiers standing guard for freedom around the world, one GI at his outpost next to the Iron Curtain seemed to sum up the hopes of mankind.
I've been on the border approximately 15 months now, in Germany 15 months, and this will be my fourth border tour. As I look across the Iron Curtain now, with three strands of barbed wire and all the Czechoslovakian personnel, I am very thankful that I am on this side. I hope that all the people, free people of the world, will say a prayer that we will have everlasting peace.
And as this new year begins, the entire world joins in that prayer. That, in part, was 1954, a year certainly to remember. Guns fell silent, diplomats and politicians argued and sometimes agreed, new leaders stepped upon the world stage. Some of the voices you heard, some of the events reported, may have an important influence on the future we face. But whatever happens or wherever, we of CBS News will try to be there. Again in 1955, we'll try to bring you an honest account of what we see and what we hear. So on behalf of many valued colleagues the world around, this is Frank Goss, wishing you the very happiest new year the future can provide. And let us all hope, let us all pray, that these 12 months to come provide peacefully and well. This was 1954, a review of the voices and events of the year just passed, came to you from CBS West Coast Radio News Headquarters in Hollywood, edited and written by Barney Miller and Max Robey.